Hello, my name is Lawrence Woodruff, and I am confident I can nurture the collective efficacy of my classroom.
And I'm Michael Ralph, and I am confident I can nurture the collective efficacy of an interdisciplinary research team.
Professional development requires ongoing reflection and dialogue.
So join us as we spend our Saturday discussing education research and drinking beer.
Today, we are drinking Bruin beer from the Echelle Trappist Brewery.
Whoa, there's a lot of mist coming off of this one.
It's an 8%er, and I took that mist and it smelled sweet.
It is aggressively carbonated. It's pouring like a fountain drink.
Agreed. And it is brown, but it's a light brown.
Oh my gosh, kind of a yellow brown. It smells so good.
I got bubbles in my nose.
It does. It smells that like brown, amber.
Just the head to me has a citrusy taste to it.
That doesn't surprise me, just given the smell.
We will tell you more later. What are we doing today, Dr. Ralph?
More schools are looking to address the socio-emotional needs of students, and a key area for that work is helping students manage anxiety in the classroom. We look at a study showing how some accommodations may be reinforcing their anxiety, and how teachers can help students develop healthier strategies for managing it. Later, we read a study of principal characteristics that support teacher self-efficacy and a shared sense of collective efficacy. Communication and modeling are essential, while coercion is deeply ineffective. Let's get started. For our first segment, we read Child Avoidance of Anxiety-Provoking Situations in the Classroom and Teacher Accommodation.
This was written by Golda Ginsburg, Jeffrey Pella, Annalise DeVito, and Grace Chan.
And was published in the Journal of Psychologists and Counselors in Schools in 2023. This study examines elementary school students with anxiety avoiding situations in the classroom and teachers accommodating such behavior. Findings suggest a significant relationship between teacher accommodation and student avoidance and anxiety, highlighting the need to differentiate between helpful and indulgent accommodations. I queued this paper up because around the turn of the year, there are a lot of outlets that do roundups of big research studies out there in education. You longtime listeners know we've had a couple of appearances from Yuki Terada out at Edutopia. He does some really great research roundups every year. And so as I was looking through EdWeek's education roundup for 2023, this study was on that list, and I thought it was a really compelling opportunity to get into a key socio-emotional outcome in classrooms with anxiety and anxiety-provoking situations, but also an opportunity to think directly about the role of the teacher and how they can influence those situations.
When I experienced this, I read the title Child Avoidance of Anxiety Provoking Situation in the Classroom and Teacher Accommodation, and my brain went to a place saying, hey, kids are stressed out by stuff. Here's how things that you can do to alleviate their stress, sort of like, you know, standard, you know, IEP 504 differentiate instruction types things. And then I would say pleasantly, but I was challenged, like, nope, that's not this paper. That's not what you think that this is not what you think it is. And it has been tremendously informative for me because I have been feeling a lot of professional lack of confidence this year. And I think I have created for myself a circumstance that this paper directly addresses, and it really, I'm excited about going back to school next week.
Good.
I'm excited. This speaks to something. When I've been probably unfairly and in an unhealthy way comparing my pre-COVID practice and my post-COVID practice, my pre-COVID outcomes and my post-COVID outcomes with my kids. And I'm just like, why are things happening the way they are? And I think it's because I was less permissive with avoidance strategies before COVID and more permissive with avoidance strategies post-COVID. Like, pre-COVID, these kids could wave the banner, struggle well, and know exactly what I meant. And this year, I don't think they would associate that phrase with me. And that is something I can change. So this paper was really great.
Good.
I loved reading this. So this paper basically suggests that there are maybe some problems with some of our business as usual approaches to student anxiety in the classroom. And Mr. Ralph said a little earlier, that accommodations within teacher speak has one meaning, and then there's a slightly different, although very overlapping, potentially overlapping meaning in the psychology world. And this paper kind of discusses that overlap, that when we have a 504 or an IEP or a student with learning needs or situational needs, we can accommodate those needs by making changes and differentiating in our classroom, which might be allowing a student to leave the classroom to take a exam, or allow a student to maybe, instead of communicating in front of their peers, they write the paper and submit it to you privately, or providing multiple avenues, choices, outlets for students to manage their relationship to the learning while also managing their relationship emotionally. So accommodations provide these opportunities and options for students, which I think that in general is a good thing. Psychologically, accommodation means kind of giving in to the insecurities of students so they don't have to deal with the situation that induces the anxiety. That's why the phrase avoidant is in this paper many times. So the student finds a way, they're supposed to present that day, but they find a way to be held back in their prior teacher's classroom for 20 minutes so that they're not there at the time that they were supposed to perform, buying themselves possibly dodging the circumstance. We may, as teachers, seen students who try to game the assistants to avoid something. Now, that's an extreme example, but that's the kind of accommodation psychologically. They are finding ways to not face the anxiety. And we as teachers might be causing problems.
And one of the key outcomes, if we're going to jump straight into some of what their data says, is as they were talking to, it was about 31 elementary school teachers, all of whom are working with at least one student who is diagnosed with with anxiety in some shape or form. And as they asked them, how often do you do some of these accommodation things in that broader definition? And they gave specific examples. How often do you do some of these things? What they found is everybody, 100%. Every single teacher engaged in some of these behaviors sometimes. And the behaviors are all pretty different. A lot of them engage in some of the behaviors fairly frequently. And I think for me, thinking about if I was in my classroom, being intentional about which of those behaviors are supports that I'm providing to help students productively practice navigating situations versus which of those behaviors become a habit or become an expectation, become something that gets taken for granted, rather than engaging in the, I'm going to say, productive struggle to try to continue to get better. And I can give you an example from outside the classroom, from my own life, from today. I read this paper while I was navigating a relevant situation with my children today, like as I'm reading it, where there was an example where one of my elementary age children had occasion to go to a birthday party today. It's where they are right now. And the birthday party is held at a particular place, like a kid's activity zone, that's really, really stimulating. And in fact, last time we were there, one of the children was severely overstimulated to the point she had to leave the environment. I actually had to go pick her up. I wasn't there when they first went, and I had to go pick her up because she was not willing to reenter the building. Was in full scale panic, like real, real big problem. And then she learned that this birthday party they were scheduled to attend was being hosted at that same place. And she asked, "Do I have to go?" She wants to go. She wants to like participate in the birthday party with her friend, but does not want to go back to that place again. And so we had to navigate that, this, like literally what this paper is about. She was experiencing anxiety. She was asking me for accommodations. Will you come pick me up? Can I sit out? But I don't feel good about sitting out because then I will be left out of some of the activities with my friends. What can we do something else? Can I go do some other special thing? And so I had a moment where I was making decisions about what am I going to provide as a caregiver to help her navigate this situation. And it can be tempting knowing that I feel really good about picking her up last time. She was in a full panic situation like that. I don't feel there was any ambiguity about. If I tell her, yeah, you don't have to go this time, I'm not sure that would give her the opportunity to productively practice navigating high sensory input situations. She's also older than she was then. We have more strategies. We have sensory protection that she owns that she can bring. She can wear ear protection so that there's less input. We have strategies to use to help her feel good about participating in that environment that we didn't have last time. And if I just say, you don't have to go as a parent, she would not have the opportunity to practice those strategies. And it would further entrench her story that she tells herself,
right,
that she can't go to those things. And so my wife and I talked a lot about this morning. My big takeaway from this paper is how to identify the zone of proximal development for children in this context of their level of anxiety and their ability to navigate anxiety, which is different, I think, than their ZPD for academic outcomes, but I think is just as relevant for making decisions of what supports are necessary and what supports are not necessary navigating a situation, especially when teachers have very large variance in how much learning and preparation they have to navigate psychological issues. And so the end of my child story is we said, why don't you go? We'll be there to help you. We'll make sure that we've got these other supports ready if you need them, but we need to try to navigate this situation together. And so she was willing to do that after some discussion, and she had an amazing time doing specifically the things that she was worried about. And like, that's not a guarantee that it'll always be great if you just grit your teeth and tough it out. That's not what I'm saying. Every case is unique. But what I am telling you is in this specific story, she needed to be able to work through that and engage the situation. And that's what a lot of the literature that they cite in this paper is also talking about, is that process of learning to negotiate these situations and learning to manage the anxiety requires practice. It cannot always be avoided.
Yeah. Growth requires struggle, but it needs to be productive struggle. And as caretakers and teachers and guiding students through that struggle and offering the appropriate scaffold to face the anxiety is different than allowing them to avoid the anxiety, removing the anxiety. Now, we know that, you know, an overload of anxiety is going to release enough cortisol to stunt that hippocampus, and you can't do higher order thinking, and you're going to get, you know, test anxiety, you're going to get performance anxiety, and you're not going to be able to perform, and you're going to stutter, and you're going to get stunned, and it's going to shut down, and it's going to reinforce those narratives, the I can't narratives. But if they do not, but growth requires struggle. And we've said it a few times, I think in a recent episode, that you're going to have a little bit of cortisol to recognize that you have to do some work to progress. And that's where the line is here. And this isn't just we can get more growth out of them if we put a little bit of pressure on them. Because the most powerful finding in the numbers in this paper is that teachers who have increased incidence of accommodating students' avoidance of anxiety have students with higher avoidance behaviors and higher anxiety levels. So it's making it worse.
I don't take that for granted. And I think that they acknowledge it, but it's a bigger deal to me than what they made in the paper. Because what they calculated was a correlation. And I think the literal note that I made in my journal, this is a meaningful case of correlation does not equal causation. And so I actually predict the more compelling narrative is if a child is navigating more severe anxiety, their ZPD is further along in needing accommodations and supports. And so I am going to more frequently provide those supports because it's appropriate because they have more severe anxiety. And so and their data doesn't speak to the directionality of that, like which one is causing which, or perhaps they're mutually reinforcing. But it is something to think about. What role do we have as individual teachers in allowing things to progress, which then reinforces and increases the severity of the anxiety around the conditions, versus are we responding appropriately to severe anxiety by allowing or providing more accommodation? Because I can imagine scenarios where both could be playing out.
I see that. And, you know, if I make mistakes, it's usually in the overestimation of my agency. So I'll go ahead and file that away as hold your horses, Woodruff. But again, speaking specifically to me, they found that experienced teachers are more likely to engage in anxiety avoidance accommodations, and male teachers are more likely to engage in these anxiety avoidance accommodations. Well, guess who is an experienced male teacher? This guy. And so it was like lightning bolts. I have been puzzling, why are things so different pre-COVID from post-COVID? And that's because interventions that you might engage in during a crisis aren't necessarily the right interventions and changes that you make 3 years after a crisis. And so if I'm going to be different, so is my classroom. And it's not necessarily that the kids are different, although I'm sure that they are. I am also different. And so different things happen in my classroom. I am the individual most responsible for the culture, climate, and community of the classroom and how it feels. And if I don't want it to feel the way it is, then I need to make some changes. And this paper really woke me up that I am doing this. I am allowing students to take advantage of some of my policies that permit anxiety avoidance as an accommodation that is slowing our community of learning. And I have to be responsible for that, and I have to change it.
Thinking about more concrete examples, I actually saw some overlap with some of the misapplications of learning styles in some of the same recommendations, because the number one category for sources of anxiety that they found in this study were performance elements. And that ranges widely, but if I have to do something myself, or especially if I have to do something in front of my peers, those were the most common sources of anxiety-inducing situations. And it actually made me think of which things are going on in the classroom that are provoking anxiety for students because of some mental health situation that they're navigating that is distinct to them, compared to things that are prompting anxiety that are just a part of appropriate normative growth for people. And I can think of an example of, if I have to stand up and read a passage in front of my peers when I'm in second grade, that might give me anxiety. And I can imagine that maps perfectly onto how many adults would respond if they had to stand up and give a speech in front of 2,000 of their peers.
Right.
Like that, if you've never done that before, you might be sweating bullets. In fact, we know that's like the number one fear among adults.
Right.
And that's just because they haven't done it before. If you talk to professional speakers, they feel amazing on the stage. That's what they want to be doing. And it's a function of practice. And so I think one of the things that can be a takeaway here is asking ourselves, and perhaps even dialoguing with students, about why do you feel anxiety, facilitating a consideration of, do you feel anxiety just because it's something that is under-practiced for you? Because one of the misapplications of learning styles is, well, if I don't like to read, I might define myself as not a reading type learner. And so I avoid reading. I want to do other things to learn. And that could be a self-reinforcing cycle of, I remain under practiced at reading because I am avoiding it. And I think this could be a similar function of, I remain under practiced in some of these situations that I'm avoiding, when really I just need to develop familiarity and practice in those areas, just like a suite of other skills that I need to be developing. And what is important here is to recognize, if you as a listener are thinking about a specific student who is navigating a situation, me, Michael Ralph, I don't know who you are, and I don't know who that student is, and I don't know what's going on. So some students will be navigating mental health situations, and we need to read and abide by the 504s and IEPs. Like, that's true and real. But also not making assumptions about who can and can't do things, because many students might feel anxiety around underpracticed skills, and the answer for that is to further practice those skills.
As a teacher, your role in creating a classroom community, a learning community that encourages academic risks, does not judge academic mistakes, supports each other through improving their work, has these collective dialogues and edit revisions and improving of each other's work and submitting yours for that same kind of critique in a way where we know that the common goal is for us to do better together, that is a safe way to accommodate a student's a relationship with their performance anxiety. So we can create an environment where we will safely expose them to their fears, knowing that they are not alone and that they will be supported by not just you, but also other students in the classroom. And I'm not saying that is easy. I'm not saying like, oh, just do that and everything is fine. But we can be doing that. We can be working to create that environment. And I think we should. I think we should be working to create that environment, because that is the one where they accept that they're going to try new hard things that they didn't believe they could do before, and then impress themselves, building the self-efficacy they need to continue to grow when they're outside of your classroom. And also, there's not absolutes. If we refer back to the story of your kid, it's okay to not go to a party. And sometimes not going to a party today is going to be the right answer. So it's not a blanket, never let them avoid. It is recognize an avoidance pattern over time is less healthy than one where we learn how to struggle through the anxiety and empower ourselves to face it in a healthy manner.
And so for teachers who have access to a school psychologist, that is the great time to go and engage a professional who has training and experience navigating those kinds of situations. Like, tag them in. They're on your team. They're on the student's team. Get some advice, get some support, so that you can more confidently and accurately identify the healthy ways to help them have exposures to continue to develop the skill without doing harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go school psychologists.
Absolutely.
Empower each other.
For our second segment, we read Teachers' Perspectives on Teacher Self-Efficacy and Principal Leadership Characteristics.
This was written by Carolyn Hayward and Matthew Olson.
Published in International Journal of Education Policy and Leadership in 2023. This study explores how elementary teachers perceive their self-efficacy and the impact of principal leadership characteristics, particularly during the COVID-19 crisis. Effective communication, empowerment, and consideration from principals were key factors in enhancing teacher self-efficacy. Leaders should prioritize building teacher self-efficacy and collective efficacy for improved student achievement.
Why did you cue this paper?
We cued this paper with a shout-out. This was a listener recommendation from Principal Moore, so thank you for suggesting we look into this topic and bringing us to this paper. One of the things that I loved, and it actually influenced our introduction to this episode, in their initial introduction material, was laying out there exists a sense of individual efficacy, and that's something that I know you and I have both thought about in some of our past work. How good am I at what I do? How able am I to affect the futures that I want for my classroom and for my practice? But then that is also situated within a broader concept of group efficacy. How good are we at being able to affect a future that we want together? And I really enjoyed being exposed to that idea. I never thought about it in that way before, but it immediately made me think of when I was able to share a department with you, and there was definitively a pretty crystallized version of a we. Like, we are good at teaching science. We do science in these ways. And individually, we're good at different things, and we have different capabilities, but there was a together, we can do this, that was compelling and that was anchoring, that made me feel really good about being a part of that group. And I think, as I imagine doing a principal type job, developing that sense of shared collective efficacy is a huge piece of what principals are striving for.
Both of these papers today specifically spoke to some insecurities that I was having during this school year, which I may have already discussed a time or two on air. I don't remember if I did or not, but I've been struggling with my relationship to my self-efficacy in my classroom, maybe making some unfair comparisons to the past, maybe not meeting some educational goals that I have for my students on the timeline that I expected. Just really seeing a lot of the things that I'm not doing well. And the introduction just clearly, boldly, plainly communicates that teachers with higher levels of self-efficacy have students with higher levels of achievement. That the teacher's confidence matters. Their belief in their ability to support student learning matters. And I have kind of experienced that when I'm interacting with other teachers, when I can see insecurity in a teacher and say, well, then let's look at that and improve that so that we can build some confidence in our choices, confidence in our relationships, and get out of this rut we're in. But I had never really seen I hadn't seen that as a problem in myself, not one that I actually have to face very often. Because even when I do have an issue, when I do have a problem, when I am stuck, I'm like, well, I just got to think real hard and talk to people in order to get out of this. And then we're going to do something different and we're going to get out of it. This past school year, that hasn't really been a part of my toolkit. And so this, like, confidence matters, it really hit me really well. And so I am going to conscientiously remind myself that I can do this. I'm going to find a way to do it.
There was one line, it was an innocuous reference in their introduction, but I highlighted it because I got so excited about it. They referenced a specific study from a little while ago, where they were studying what are the practices that effective principals are promoting. And the number one takeaway, and I'm just going to read it to you, is that principals who talk with teachers to promote reflection on practice and promoting professional growth for teachers were important attributes for effective leaders. And I was like, boom, like, that is what we are here to do. Amazing.
I had the same lightning bolt moment, and I nearly fell apart during our opening, because I say professional development requires ongoing reflection and dialogue every single week. Like, it's just the same sentence with the verbs in switched order. They said dialogue that promotes reflection, and we say ongoing reflection and dialogue. But they just put that tagline in the paper, and I just rejoiced when I saw it.
I think the big takeaway from some of their study, what they did, they sent a survey to a bunch of teachers who were willing to respond in Florida. This was when the COVID disruptions were significant, and asked them about what are some of the principal characteristics that you're experiencing and how important are they, and what is your degree of self-efficacy? And then we've got a whole bunch of like descriptives about like what were their responses and what did they come with. And there were a couple of very common themes, although a lot of the responses were really similar. One of the top themes out there that I got the most excited about, due to my pre-existing conceptions of what are required for good leadership, is modeling instructional expectations. And that was something that was present in their literature review early on, and also in some of their data. Like, a lot of the responses are really similar. So, like, they like a lot of the things that they measured. For instance, one of their precedent studies that they cite in the literature review pointed out that the vast majority of teachers in all of their categories have studied was that modeling expectations from principals is a big deal, and modeling expectations is in this study, and it's strong. Like it's not significantly different in its importance until they start ranking them in order to try to separate some of these impacts. And so I don't know that I'm going to revolutionize the world by saying principals should communicate with their staff. I don't think I'm going to knock anybody out of their chair.
But I think we should stress that that should happen at both levels. That should happen both at the I'm communicating to my staff as a whole, but also I'm communicating to my staff as individuals. That's a lot of communication.
But it's my understanding you have a lot of things to do in any given day. And so really, I think the issue is how can principals carve out for themselves? How can superintendents and headshed folks, people who work at the administrative office, how can they protect principal time so they have capacity to be in teachers' classrooms, to take meetings, to hang out at the where they're getting coffee and talk with a teacher? What's going on in your classroom? And there are a lot of things that are pushing principals away from doing those things, but those are the things that this research and the research they cite are saying are most impactful for supporting teacher efficacy, and teacher efficacy is very tightly connected to student achievement.
Yeah, I underlined this statement. Teacher self-efficacy is a high-yield asset. Teacher self-efficacy is a high-yield asset. When teachers believe they can help students learn, address students' mental health issues, navigate complex logistical concerns, when teachers believe that they can blank, whatever the concerns of those teachers are, when they believe that they can, good things happen for students. Good things happen for other teachers. And so if we know interactions with principals, healthy communication with principals is a way to support teacher self-efficacy, then really this paper is for district admin.
Yeah, people who can implement it. Yeah.
Who are the people that can buy their principals more time to be people with their teachers? When principals can be people with their teachers, your schools do better. And that's a district admin efficacy issue. Mm-hmm. What can you do as district admin to get your principals more time with their teachers?
I will say this, there is a takeaway for principals and VPs themselves. And it's not at the top of the list, it's at the bottom of the list. The like uniformly lowest scoring item in all of this is contingent rewards. Teachers do not want to be coerced. And you know what? I can confirm I don't want to be coerced.
Absolutely. I was asked by an admin, I don't know, 6 years ago, maybe seven, to be the Science Olympiad sponsor for our school. And that's not something I want to do. I have my own personal reasons that I'm not super excited about the Science Olympiad programs, that I would rather people that are passionate about it take responsibility for that. I don't want to do it. And the principal, that the assistant principal then asked me if I knew that there was a stipend involved, would that change the needle at all? And I said the exact opposite. I would feel terrible about myself for compromising my priorities by being paid for doing something I don't believe in. The exact opposite.
I think that story is probably to replace me as the Science Olympiad coach. I think it was.
Yeah.
And why did I take the Science Olympiad position? Like, I love science and I like making things, but I didn't like it's not a priority for me either. And in my first year of teaching, somebody came to me and said, we need somebody to cover this departmental priority. And like, honestly, it didn't really matter what it was. I was like, I'm a new teacher. I want to be a member of this department. I opened this segment talking about collective efficacy. And they're like, the team needs you. Can we put you in? Put me in, coach.
Absolutely.
Has nothing to do with the stipend, like, or anything for that. Right. But like, I am here for the team and the shared vision. We have a shared vision of applied relevant science experiences, extracurriculars. Can you go help Katie out? yes, I will show up and I will keep track of where students are on field trips. And I don't want to, but I am here to be on team science, yep. So I will. And none of that has to do with dollars and cents. And that's the same thing is true with wearing jeans. The same thing is true with parking spots. And this is in their data. It is consistently the bottom entry. And so I think if we don't want teachers to be coercing students about points in their classrooms to do trivial nonsense, then we also, as a principalship, need to not be wasting teachers' times with coercive strategies, with trivial incentives. You're here because you have your personal priorities. How can I help you pursue those priorities through my leadership lens?
In the past, I've written about this as a vocation, but this responsibility, this professional responsibility, is too complex and both emotionally and physically and intellectually demanding to want someone who's doing it because they're bribed to do it. You do not want to bribe people to be teachers. You want intellectual caregivers to be teachers. That's what you want. You want people who like to think about the complex content and like to care for other people as they grow to be teachers. You don't want to bribe them to do that. You want people who want that for themselves and for other teachers. And so if you find someone where all the extrinsic rewards is working, keep an eye on that person. That's my position.
I am consistently showing up to say pay teachers. So if somebody is so under-resourced that they have to do things they don't want to do to be able to pay the rent and to be able to keep the heat on and to be able to buy supplies and pay for the bus to be able to do what they want to do, they are doing it for the money, not because they don't care about it, because they are under-resourced. And that's a different thing. So you don't want people doing it for the money, full stop. So adequately resource them and then support them to pursue their priorities rather than coercing them with additional benefits, which I think is what we were both saying, but just to be very clear, not saying don't pay teachers, we're saying pay them enough that they are not doing it for the money and then help them do the things they are passionate about so they can do them well in the pursuit of shared goals.
Yeah. There was an interesting note in the paper about standardized testing and test scores. They kind of made a comment that suggested that standardized testing and scores hurts teachers generally in their self-efficacy, with a smaller effect, maybe a negligible effect, for teachers that already have high self-efficacy. And a week ago, 2 weeks ago, we got introduced to this centralized data system that we now as teachers have access to, that essentially have a compilation of, we can look up any student we have and see an entire history of test scores for that student. And then I just looked up a student and saw their test scores were really high, and then had this sadness about why they don't know what I expected them to know in my college biology class. Like, this student is supposed to be really a really good student, and they don't have a mastery understanding of the things that I expect them to know, even from first semester. And you know what conclusion I came to myself? I must be doing something wrong. 2 years ago, I would have never had that thought. I would have just assumed I'm the best thing in the world. Test scores are garbage. But I, being in a position during this kind of year, entering the school year with lower confidence and then like surfing on this doldrum, I then read here and I'm like, that's what happened. I saw the scores and felt bad about myself, and I haven't had the confidence that I've had in the past. I just thought that was really, if there's a discrepancy, anytime you notice a discrepancy between the student performance and what you can do, it's an opportunity for self-doubt. And as the paper communicates, teachers with doubt don't. The doubt itself is the problem. The doubt is the problem. And putting an emphasis on discussing standardized test scores is going to increase doubt with some of your most vulnerable teachers. That was a takeaway that I had from this paper. It was subtle, but it was there.
Speaking as somebody who rarely gets accused of having not enough confidence. But seeing the damage that misplaced confidence can play.
Yeah.
Right. And that's something that I've, like, I'm trying to resist pushing back because I don't want to reply guy you. Like, I don't want to do that.
No, that's fine. This is an extreme on one end. There's an extreme on the other.
So I think if somebody needs to get better at something, they need to have that information. And I don't think that you're saying that we should lie to, like, I don't think that you're in that place. But I'm thinking about how, as a principal, can you navigate a space where you need to provide feedback because teachers, like, this is the place we can go. Like, this, you're here and you do these things well, and this is what better can look like. And frankly, I want to have that conversation with every teacher. Teachers who are amazing. Here's where you're at. Here's where you can get better. And teachers who are early in their career and have lots of things they need to develop. Here's where you're at. Here's where you can get better. Like, everybody's polishing their sphere. Find a spot so you can continue polishing. And I think develop it back to that original comment about group efficacy.
Yeah.
Having a shared atmosphere, an ethos, a norm of we are all developing. We should all know what we can do well. We should all know what we're going to do better. Like, and all of us. And that is an equalizing stance. We can all be good at something. We can all be getting better at something. And so as I imagine, how can I communicate that clearly and compassionately with teachers as a principal when I have 99 other things I have to worry about that day? I think it's kind of the essence of this paper.
When you're supporting an individual teacher who has lower self-efficacy, reminding them of their strengths is important. Because when you are a new teacher, you know you are bad at your job. You know it. Like, you know you're bad at your job. I mean, there's just no getting around it, and you feel terrible. I felt terrible my first year. I don't know. I suffered my first year.
And yeah. There were things that I felt great about, and I was still like, how am I good at so many things and still so bad overall?
And so recognizing, like, being able to talk to someone and say, listen, you, I also see that you are doing this well. Continue to lean on that. We can, like, lean on that and build outward. Like, lean on it. Lean on this skill, continue to work it, and then add and focus on this other skill and have those two work in tandem with each other. Like reminding us that we have strength and that you can do this gives someone a firmer place to stand on. And that's to help maybe scaffold those teachers that are feeling that they don't know what they're doing.
Listen to teachers.
How was the beer?
The beer was wonderful. This was exactly what it smelled like. It's a rich amber, which comes with the full body, the sweetness and some of the maltiness in the early flavors, which I love. I'm fawning over it. I'm just finishing it now. Even among the wonderful year of beers we've had, this is among my favorites.
There's a little bit of spiciness to this. Just a little bit of tanginess. That some of the others didn't have. You don't taste that? At the end, the very end, it's that citrus thing that I smelled in the head.
Yeah, I think I get the citrus earlier than you do.
Maybe. So this is the Echelle Brewery, a Belgian monastery, and it was founded by relocating people from the Westmalle Brewery, which was the first beer we drank this season. So some monks from that monastery relocated to this monastery and founded it. But this monastery disbanded in 2021. Yeah, when the last monks retired, there are no monks. And what happened is the local people said, nah, screw that. And they continued to work the brewery for sustenance, and all the profits are still going to charity, but there are no longer any monks associated with this brewery. As of 2021, this beer exists because the locals think it should.
They're right.
And the profits go to charity.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been a great month. We will see you next month.
As we pursue growth,
discuss research,
and struggle well.